Certain information set forth in the podcast may contain forward-looking statements under applicable security laws. These statements are not guarantees of future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Although forward-looking statements contained in this presentation are based upon what management of the company believes to be reasonable assumptions, there can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. LifeSci Advisors and the company undertake no obligation to update forward-looking statements in the podcast should circumstances or management's estimates or opinions change. This podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to buy securities and does not constitute investment advice.
A TMAb, simply put, is an antibody that displays a great degree of selectivity for the tumor. It's not a masked antibody. There's nothing that's proteolytically cleaved. It's an antibody imbued with unique properties that allows it to bind target only in the tumor. So TMAbs really focus the binding of the antibody in and around the tumor.
Hello, my name is Neil Canavan, and this is Benchtop Bios, a podcast series by LifeSci Partners where we introduce healthcare investors to the people and the pipelines driving the biotech sector forward.
My guest today is John Shelby. He's the president and CEO of Sensei Bio. John, welcome to Benchtop Bio.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Okay, as always, for our listeners, I like to orient with the elevator pitch for the company. So, John Sensei, where are you located? How long you've been in business? And give me an idea of what you're doing there.
We're located in, primarily our headquarters are in Boston, Massachusetts. We also have a smaller site down in Rockville, Maryland. I've been with the company 5 years. The company has been around for a little over 20 years. Went public last year.
Okay, and what are you doing?
We are an immuno-oncology company focused on next-generation antibodies for cancer, and we're really focused on creating antibodies that can unlock previously undruggable immune targets.
All right. Well, always following a brief description of the company, we have a much longer description of the man who runs the company. John, that would be you. I'm usually a pretty good read of people's voices and where they might be from, but I'm not getting anything from you, John. Tell me a little bit about your background. Where are you from?
Originally from California, mostly born and bred there. Was born in Redwood City, California, in the Bay Area. Not long after I was born, we moved to Turkey, where we lived for about 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Certainly an eye-opening experience, even as a young boy. I have fond memories, very fond memories of Turkey. And then we moved back to California, and I spent my formative years growing up on the peninsula in the Bay Area.
How old were you when you came back?
About 6 years old.
So give me just one brief memory of Turkey.
I have very fond memories of the people there, how welcoming and warm they were. We used to have a cherry orchard up the hill and behind our yard. And I remember going up the hill as a kid, climbing a tree and having as many cherries as I could muster. And the guy who owned the orchard never seemed to mind. They were very friendly people, very warm, very welcoming people.
I remember I was in Istanbul for the end of Ramadan once, and they were serving cherry juice. Wow, I hadn't remembered that until you just said so. Cool. All right, so tell me a bit more about that kid. Kid into sports, you're a brainiac, you like video games. What was that kid like?
A little bit of everything. I was an active kid. I was very active. I was on my bike all the time. You know, back in those days,
it was freedom.
You could bike across town, go pick up an ice cream cone for 25 cents and just be back before supper. So I used to do a lot of that. I played sports. I played soccer for many years. I seriously injured my knee in a skateboarding accident when I was 14. And that was sort of the end of my soccer career. But in a roundabout way, it worked out. I ended up getting really into swimming. I played water polo in high school and loved it. It's a sport I fell in love with, and I can honestly say I've never been in as good shape since.
Okay, so this does not explain your next step in that path of education, which was you have a BS in biophysics from UC San Diego. John, why? I know a bit about biophysics. This is not light reading.
Well, I was pretty good at math. When I was growing up, I always had a knack for it. When I got into college, I became fascinated with cosmology. We were studying quantum mechanics, Einstein's theory of relativity. And I really got into it. I ended up combining it with biology because I couldn't make up my mind. I liked both of those sciences quite a bit. And UCSD had a biophysics degree that enabled me to do both.
See, now the problem with UCSD, I went to Rutgers in Newark, and there's nothing to do there. But there is everything to do in UCSD. Like, for instance, La Jolla Cove, do you dive?
I don't dive. I surf.
Okay.
I took advantage of that when I was in San Diego. I surfed quite a bit. I don't surf quite as much anymore, but when I was a younger man, I surfed all over the world, including Indonesia, Mexico, Hawaii. So really took to water sports and spent a lot of time in the water in my free time.
Oh, cool, cool. All right. Now, I have one other personal question, and this is going to take a little bit of patience, but I just want to just a little bit more about you. All right, so you're a class in 95. Now, five of the top albums from 95, Dookie by Green Day, the Forrest Gump soundtrack, No Need to Argue by the Cranberries, and that's where the zombie was on that album, Color of My Love by Celine Dion, and History by Michael Jackson. Which of any of those albums did you own?
That's a great question. I'm pretty sure I owned the Green Day album. I can't say that I owned any of the others, but of course we've all listened to Michael Jackson at some point along the line.
It's inevitable. But yeah, I had the, for sure I had the Cranberries. I don't remember the Green Day album. I'll have to look that one up. All right, let's get serious. Onto the career path. So your first job out of college is a company in San Francisco called Telarik. I do vaguely remember them. They were later acquired by Amgen. You were a research associate there for 3 years, lab rat, which apparently you liked so much. As soon as you wrapped up that job, you went and got an MBA and you haven't been on the bench since. What was it about the bench that was just not getting it for you?
Well, that's an interesting point. I really fell in love with biotech at Telarik. First of all, when I graduated from college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. You know, I thought I would go into something more aligned with physics. But it was a terrible time to be doing physics. It was the end of the Cold War. A lot of government money was going elsewhere, not to physics-oriented fields. And I guess I got a little bit lucky. I had an opportunity to join this young company. And I remember being one of less than half a dozen people above a garage in Burlingame, California, doing a lot of pipetting and seeing people come through the building who I later learned were really well-known people in the industry, like David Goodell, who had founded Telarik and so forth. As the company grew and became more successful, I just fell in love with the culture of biotech. One of the things I love to this day about biotech is the passion that scientists bring to the table. We had a guy who was living in a van in the parking lot so he could be closer to the bench. And I don't recommend that to anybody. I hope nobody at Sensei is doing that, but I really respected it. And at that point, I think I decided I was going to be on the operating side of the industry for my career. But you're right. I don't think the bench work was for me. I wasn't in love with it. I did love the industry. I loved the people. I loved the culture. I did not love the bench work. And so I took an unusual step of coming out of that experience and getting an MBA and really moved to the business side of the industry at that point. However, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't change a thing. I think the research experience I had has been invaluable in informing my views on how to build companies and pipelines.
All right, so let's move through that career. You did get an MBA at Carnegie Mellon. I believe I've heard of them. You then did a brief internship of Biogen, heard of them. Then an analyst position at a new ventures at Agilent Technologies. I know all these names. Roughly a year later, you move on to Cyclist Pharmaceuticals. This is a company with oncology assets that was acquired in 2003, which seems to coincide with your leaving the company. You were there as director of biz dev. Did you play a role in the acquisition?
I did. You know, Cyclist was a really interesting little company. It was pre-immuno-oncology, of course. We had licensed a asset out of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, brought it to the clinic, ran a study, looked very interesting, and then ended up getting acquired by RQL. And, you know, I played a role. I was a director of business development. So I wasn't a senior executive, but I played a role in that transaction, doing due diligence. It was my first opportunity to cut my teeth in an M&A transaction. learned a lot, and was lucky that the CEO at the time, Stephen Hill, invited me to stay on board after that. And I thought, this will be interesting. I'll help with the transition maybe for a year. I ended up staying there for 7 years and made a lot of good friends, had a lot of fun, did a lot of business development in Japan and Europe, and really cut my teeth in business development at Arcule.
So the Japanese work, you were scouting licensing opportunities. What were you doing?
We were primarily partnering our assets. The first deal we did was with Kyowa Kirin, a smaller company, but a company I have a great deal of respect for scientifically. At the time, I believe we did the largest phase one licensing deal for the Japanese territory. I think it was Japan, China, South Korea. It was a $30 million upfront deal. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. What a feeling. And we can do this again and again. And we kept going back to Japan. We ended up doing another licensing deal with Daiichi Sankyo. Then we did a third kind of platform deal with Daiichi Sankyo that really funded, I would say, the Arcule discovery engine for many years to come.
All right. So I'm going to let you perhaps toot your own horn here. As you said, you were brought over to Arcule as VP of BizDev. This company was later acquired by Merck. You were not there at the time. You had left a couple years earlier. In your opinion, BizDev activities make that an attractive target for Merck?
I think the business development work we did was pivotal in sustaining Arcule and building it into what it became. The asset that Merck acquired Arcule for may or may not have come out of the platform that the company had at the, when I was there, but the platform would not have been there but for all the business development work we did. So I'm incredibly proud of that. And I think we played an important role in ensuring that the science there survived because, you know, like so many companies in the industry, there are ups and downs. And Arcule had its share of ups and downs before it really had a promising candidate.
All right. So finally, you moved on from there to a company called X4, and we're about to get to Sensei in just a moment. But first, I need to mention about X4. This company is in the immuno-oncology space by way of chemokines. And in the description of the company of X4, there the phrase used called immunosurveillance. Now, I want to read an excerpt from the book that I wrote about cancer immunotherapy. This is the front of chapter 7, and the quote is this. "We all know that cancer immunosurveillance does not exist," end quote. Now, this was a comment by a reviewer on a paper that had been submitted to a journal by a man named Dr. Robert Schreiber, who then later proved that the reviewer was an idiot and that surveillance does in fact exist. And Dr. Schreiber is now famous for that discovery. And you met him and he has a part in your company. So walk me through, how'd you meet Bob?
I met Bob first in 2011 when I was interviewing for my first C-level role at a company called Igenica Biotherapeutics, where Bob was a founder. I flew out to San Francisco. I met Bob. He took me through, what a treat. He took me through some of the basics of immunoediting, really a field that he pioneered. And he played a very active role in the early days at Igenica. We worked very closely with his lab. And he would quite often come to Igenica and give us a lecture on cancer immune editing. So it was a fun time to be working with somebody who's really, I think, a pioneer in the immuno-oncology space.
And how is he involved in Sensei?
So Bob is a member of our immuno-oncology advisory board. We also collaborate with Bob. We recently published a poster at NAACR meeting in collaboration with Bob's lab. So we work very closely with Bob on a number of things. He also acts as an advisor to the company.
Splendid. He's actually one of my most favorite people. Just a terrific guy. All right, so let's go on to Sensei and your assets. This is a platform play for investors out there. We love to hear platform. This is something called T-MABs. Now, John, what is a T-MAB and what can we do with it?
A T-MAB, simply put, is an antibody that displays a great degree of selectivity for the tumor. It's not a masked antibody. There's nothing that's proteolytically cleaved. It's an antibody imbued with unique properties that allows it to bind target only in the tumor. That's a property of the antibody or the protein itself rather than some sort of a cleavable mask. And The premise is that there are many different immune targets out there that have been extremely challenging to drug by virtue of the fact that they're expressed in the periphery. And so TMAbs are really designed to avoid that issue, which can lead to a lot of downstream effects you want to avoid, and really focus the binding of the antibody in and around the tumor.
So you're taking advantage of a conformational change.
Yes, in some cases we are. We're taking advantage of some intrinsic properties of tumors, such as the fact that when they grow to a certain size, they metabolize energy differently. It's Warburg metabolism. Mm-hmm. And this creates a slightly lower pH environment. pH, as you know, is a measure of acidity. When proteins are in lower pH conditions, certain amino acids gain a proton. Those tend to be histidine molecules.
Got it.
That one proton difference, believe it or not, can be detected by an antibody. It can subtly change the conformation of an epitope, and it also can subtly change the charge in a way that an antibody can distinguish from the same protein at physiological pH.
Okay. That part makes sense to me. The next part, I'm going to take a little more convincing, because your lead asset, you're chasing something called VISTA. This is immunotherapy checkpoint. And this has become something of a sore point with investors, not VISTA per se, but checkpoints. After Keytruda was approved in 2014, everybody thought, okay, there's going to be a gold rush now. We have all these targets. We are actually going to cure cancer. I had conversations with very serious scientists like, yeah, this is it. This is what we're going to do. And then IDO blew up. And then ICOS didn't really go anywhere. And then TIGIT's sort of floundering. And STING's not going anywhere. And investors are kind of like, ugh. So convince me, John, VISTA's different.
Yeah, those are all really important points. And it actually informs the way we've built TMAb. It's the reason we built TMAb. Our hypothesis is that the real problem we're facing in immuno-oncology is that conventional antibodies are targeted to immune checkpoints that are expressed in normal tissues. That leaves to a number of factors you want to avoid. Dose-limiting toxicities, for example, can result from antibodies binding target in normal tissues as a result of on-target but off-tumor binding. There's quite often an effect we call target-mediated drug disposition, which leads to very poor PK and high clearance from the blood. That results in a need for higher and more frequent dosing.
I'm sorry, could you explain that phenomenon just briefly for me? I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, target-mediated drug disposition is sort of a fancy industry term just to say that the antibody is binding and being cleared from the periphery as a result of on-target binding. So the more target you have, the faster the antibody is cleared. With immune targets, it's a real problem because the immune system is everywhere. It's not just in the tumor. And so you get a high level of target-mediated drug disposition. That leads to a need for higher doses and more frequent dosing. Now, that combined with the dose-limiting toxicities, you know, really conspire to create a third issue, which is suboptimal activity. Because if you're running into dose-limiting toxicities, you may not have the target coverage, the receptor occupancy you need for optimal activity.
Got it. Okay. For those listeners who are still not quite convinced, there is a good body of literature here. I do have one suggestion for you. This article is from 2021. It's in Trends in Immunology. The title is VISTA, a Mediator of Quiescence and a Promising Target for Cancer Immunotherapy. This was written by the lead author from Dana-Farber, a man named Gordon Freeman, who, if listeners don't know, he was the instrumental in the discovery of PD-1 and arguably should have been included in the Nobel Prize. He also happens to be a super nice guy. Now, the first sentence of this article reads, quote, "The V-domain Ig suppressor of T-cell activation, or VISTA, is a B7 family member that maintains T-cell and myeloid quiescence and is a promising target for combination cancer immunotherapy," end quote. I'm going to ask about the combination a little bit later in your clinical programs. All right, so the secret sauce here is the protonated histidine, but you also have something else here, which is the Fc portion, which you believe is also important for the activity of your asset. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, one of the unique things about VISTA is that it is highly expressed on myeloid cells. And myeloid cells are practically ubiquitous. They're much more common in tumors than T cells. You do see sometimes VISTA expressed on the tumor itself or on T cells, but I would say the majority of the expression of VISTA is found on myeloid cells. So we created an antibody that has this pH-sensitive binding to VISTA in the tumor, and it's an IgG1 framework. It's got an active Fc, and the properties of that antibody enable it to lead to myeloid and myeloid clustering, which is an important feature for some immuno-oncology antibodies, and it can really lead to a conversion of the myeloid phenotype from suppressive to now either neutral or actually activating T cells. So okay. Without that clustering, that effect may not occur at all.
Let's see if I remember my biology from M2 to M1.
On macrophages, that's right.
Got it. Okay, good. All right, so you have been working with this molecule in preclinical. You did mention you presented some results at AACR this year, and you will present results next week at SITC. Although, listeners, we're recording on November 3rd, so the information I'm asking for is no longer embargoed. So, John, tell me a bit about what you're saying.
Yeah, I think we've looked very deeply into the mechanism of action of our antibody, and in particular at some of the challenges that have been associated with VISTA in our preclinical work. One of those challenges has been cytokine release syndrome. So J&J ran a study in 2016, ended up halting the study after about 12 patients due to cytokine release syndrome. So we've run CRS models in a number of different ways. I think the most sophisticated way is we've looked at it in a continuous loop system. So it very much mimics blood in circulation. And we found that our antibody is at least an order of magnitude lower in terms of activating the key cytokines that are responsible for CRS in many instances. Another part of the preclinical package we view as really important is, of course, the PK. Challenges with VISTA antibodies and PK have been really clear. A number of antibodies have gone to clinic that have half-lives of 24 to 48 hours, which makes them really challenging from a commercial perspective. So we've looked at PK in a number of different ways. We've done studies in monkeys that show really nice linear elimination kinetics. I think one of the most interesting experiments we did was actually a PK experiment in mice. We looked at mice that had wild type mouse VISTA, which our antibody doesn't bind to get a sense of what the clearance rate was of the antibody. And we also ran in parallel mice that had a human VISTA knock-in protein knocked into the mouse locus. And interestingly, the clearance of the antibody in those mice was about the same. When we implanted a tumor in those VISTA knock-in mice, the PK was very different. Once the tumor grew to a large enough size, Warburg metabolism kicked in, the pH within the tumor dropped, and you saw this precipitous drop in the antibody in the blood. So it began to clear much more quickly. And that spoke to us that our antibody was doing exactly what we had intended it to do. It's not binding VISTA in the blood. It is binding VISTA in the tumor.
So after the warm reception you will get at SITC, what's next?
We are looking forward to filing an IND in the first half of next year and becoming a clinical stage company again. It's so close, we can taste it.
So you've obviously given some thought as to what that phase one is going to look like. What's it going to look like?
I think you're not going to see anything too unusual for phase one. We're going to do a dose escalation study, both as monotherapy and in combination. And once those...
Whoa, combination. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're very interested in studying VISTA, both as monotherapy and in combination. We think first of all, in every preclinical efficacy model we've run, whenever you see anti-PD-1 work, anti-VISTA makes it better, even in PD-1 resistant models. So we think that's a very interesting opportunity. Monotherapy is very interesting too. You know, there are certain indications like colorectal cancer, for example, where you actually microsatellite stable colorectal cancer, where these tumors mm-hmm. actually are inflamed and they're hot, but the response rate to PD-1 is incredibly low. It suggests the possibility that maybe there is another dominant checkpoint creating suppression within that tumor. So we're interested in indications like that. You know, we haven't made our selections for phase two or our expansion cohorts yet, but we're interested in indications like that where we think VISTA may play a very important role.
Have you looked into lining up investigative centers yet?
Oh, we sure have. Yeah. At this point, we've manufactured the drug. We've made our CRO selection. We've got a short list of sites that we would like to work with.
Splendid. Splendid. Now, there are some competitions in this space, competitors in this space. They are mentioned in Dr. Friedman's paper. There are companies ranging from BMS to Hummingbird to J&J. A couple of big names here. What's your differentiator? Why are you confident that you can make the run here?
We really think there are three key features to really take advantage of VISTA, of blocking VISTA as an immune checkpoint. First, there are many putative receptor on T cells for VISTA. We believe very strongly that the relevant checkpoint interaction is with a protein called PSGL1. Our competitors are going after a number one. There was a very nice paper published by BMS in 2019. I believe it was Johnson et al. That described PSGL1 as the relevant checkpoint interaction. So we think that blocking the VISTA PSGL1 interaction is really the key. There are other putative receptors out there, such as V6-3 and so forth. Our antibody also blocks those, but we're really focused on PSGL1. The second feature that's really important is the pH-sensitive binding, because VISTA, it's in addition to our antibody only binding at low pH, VISTA itself has this intrinsic pH-sensitive binding to PSGL1. It's really fascinating biology. And so if you're not binding at low pH, you're not binding the active form of VISTA. So that's really important. And then the third feature we discussed earlier, which is the active FC. Now, if you look at all three of those features, our antibody is the only one that accomplishes all three of those. So we think it's very differentiated. We think we're going to be the first to truly test the VISTA immune checkpoint axis.
Got it. All right. Now, as we mentioned earlier, that this is TMAB is a platform. There are two other candidates that have been spun out of this platform machine. The first is called VISIG4, V-S-I-G-4, which I'm not familiar with. You will also be presenting some data on this at SITC next week. This is expressed on TAMs, or tumor-associated macrophages. What's the mechanism here, John? Walk me through this.
Yeah. So some similarities with VISTA. You're right. There is expression on myeloid cells here with VSIG4. VSIG4 is a little bit more of a novel target even than VISTA. I think there's a little bit less known about it, but it is a B7 family related protein. As you mentioned, it's expressed on TAMs. We think it's a really good target for a TMAP approach by virtue of the fact that there is high expression in Kupffer cells. And that's going to make it very problematic for a canonical pH neutral antibody to bind without leading to, we think, again, target mediated drug disposition, potentially dose limiting toxicities. A TMAP can avoid those issues. So we think it's really important for a target like VSIG4.
So where are we in development here?
So recently we identified a set of 8 antibodies that displayed pH selectivity for low pH versus physiological pH. All 8 of those antibodies also blocked the VSIG4 interaction with T cells. So we think they're good, what we call parental antibodies. We're in the process of optimizing now into progeny antibodies, really looking to optimize the ratio of pH selectivity.
Got it. All right. And that was one more asset I would like to mention. By the way, that was SNS-102. I now want to talk about 103. And thank you, John, for making the various iterations so simple to remember. I'm hoping 104 would be next. So the target here is CD39, but you have another name for it, which I'm not familiar with. Again, so what's the mechanism here?
Yeah, CD39 is a very interesting enzyme, actually. We call it ENTPDase1 to emphasize that it is an enzyme. It's actually the rate-limiting enzyme in the production of adenosine, which is highly immunosuppressive. So it's part of this purinergic signaling pathway, converts ATP into AMP and then adenosine, plays a very important role in that production. And it's been shown that blocking CD39 can reduce levels of adenosine in tumors and therefore reverse immunosuppression.
And where are we in development here?
So with CD39, we're just screening our first set of antibodies now.
With either of these targets, does it suggest a tumor type yet, or is it still way too early for that?
You know, I think one of the hallmarks of our programs is that these targets are expressed fairly broadly. For example, both VSIG4 and VIST are expressed on myeloid cells, which are fairly ubiquitous in tumors. So you've got a kind of a good problem to have of picking from a broad number of indications.
And finally, for overall, I know the VISTA asset we're looking to combine, I assume, with PD-1. Would these likely be used in combination as well, or do you know?
I think it's natural for us to look at combinations with PD-1. We're interested in other combinations as well, certainly CTLA-4 and also LAG-3, now that that molecule, our first LAG-3 inhibitor, is approved.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask two more questions, one for the lawyers, one for the bankers. I think the lawyer question I probably already know. Is this IP already in-house? You're generating these things in-house?
That's right. Our IP really rests with the antibodies themselves primarily. We've already filed our provisional applications for our anti-VISTA antibodies. And, you know, we typically file for worldwide rights and so forth.
Okay. And then finally, for the bankers, we need to talk about some money. So give me an idea of your current runway. And what sort of conversations might you want to have in San Francisco in just a couple of months here at JP Morgan?
Yeah. So right now we have cash runway into the first quarter of 2025, assuming we stick with our current operating plan. So that's plenty of runway, Neil, to turn over our phase 1 cards and get into phase 2. As you can imagine, next generation antibodies garner a lot of interest. So we are in discussions with investors all the time about how we can work with them to advance our pipeline.
Are you open to out-licensing?
You know, the answer is always yes for the right deal. It's important for companies like Sensei that are young and growing to partner with companies that can enhance our capabilities and bring their assets to bear. So we talk to partners, potential partners, all the time about how we can work with them to further develop our pipeline and also offset the spending when you get into clinical development.
All right. Actually, one last question. Am I going to get to see you at Sensei?
We are going to be there. I hope to see you there as well, Neil.
All right. Well, maybe at the Checkpoints concert there on the dance floor. All right. Today, ladies and gentlemen, this is a wrap. And my guest has been John Chalby. He is the president and CEO of Sensei Bio. John, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Benchtop Bios. I hope that this episode will serve as yet another data point to guide you in your investment strategies. If you wish to hear more of Life Size Benchtop Bios, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if there's a company or a particular executive you'd like to get to know, I do take requests. Please send those to ncanada@lifesciadvisors.com. Until next week then, goodbye, or for that matter, good sell, whatever boosts your portfolio.